We made this.
Ladies and gentlemen, it was a cold-blooded, premeditated murder.
Hello, everyone. This is the Red and Buried podcast, but things are a little different this week. Sarah rudely decided to take a holiday with her family, who she hasn't seen in 5 years. I know her priorities are completely out of whack. So our next episode is going to be a little later than planned this month. However, I didn't want to leave you with nothing on the first Friday of the month, so I thought I'd give you a taste of my new podcast. In case you missed our last episode, The Labours of Hercule is presented by me and the ever so wonderful Adam Roach. Go and give that episode a listen if you want to get to know him better. It's a lot of fun. In The Labours of Hercule, we'll be taking a deep dive into every episode of Agatha Christie's Poirot, that masterpiece of television starring the incomparable David Suchet, and giving you the clues you need to solve the case. Our first episode, however, is simply a gush fest over how much Adam and I love all aspects of the show, Suchet, and Agatha Christie in general. From episode 2 onwards, it's more about the clues and solving the cases with a hefty dollop of gushing on the side. If you like to challenge your little grey cells while revelling in the perfection of David Suchet's Poirot, as well as the genius of Agatha Christie, this is the podcast for you. If you like it, hopefully you'll head over and subscribe to The Labours of Hercule wherever you get your podcasts. If you don't, fear not, we'll be back to our regularly scheduled programming very soon. For now, have your moustache pomade at the ready, and let's get into some hot Suchet action. Enjoy, mon ami!
Bonjour.
Can you do a Poirot impression?
About as well as anyone else can, apart from David Suchet.
I don't know. I think you can do it better. I want to hear you do it.
I could probably walk like him.
With the coin.
The coin.
You could say he coined the walk.
E.
You shouldn't say that. No one should say that.
You're on fire.
No. You're very generous with your fire.
Thank you. I've got a question for you then.
Okay.
How much do you love David Suchet's Poirot?
It's impossible to quantify, isn't it?
No, you have to quantify it in one word.
Entirely.
Entirely, nice.
What about you?
Yeah, I was going to say entirely as well. No, I don't know what to say.
Well, you actually.
Absolument.
That's better.
Is that a French
That's
word?
Good.
Or is that a Belgian word?
Doesn't really matter, does it? French-Belgian. It's all good.
Don't say that to Poirot.
He speaks French, but he just, you know. Unless you know the Flemish for it.
I don't even think Belgians know the Flemish for it.
Depends what part of Belgium you're in. Have you ever been to Belgium?
No. Have you?
Yeah, it's really cool.
That doesn't surprise me. You have a Poirot tattoo.
I have 3 Poirot tattoos.
You think you're more qualified to talk about David Suchet's Poirot than I am?
I don't think that's true.
Well, I think you are. I've seen the video of your wedding.
Yes, when I married David Suchet. Sadly not.
I love him very much. You've seen him live as well, haven't you?
Okay, that makes it sound like I'm watching him or outside his house a lot. And it's not as much as you'd think. I've seen him do his Poirot and Me thing. And I've seen him in conversation, and I've seen him in a couple of plays, and at a book signing. It does sound like I'm stalking him, actually, now that I'm listing this off.
I've seen him in bed. I've seen him
through the window. I've seen him in the shower.
I've seen him on the toilet.
It's just, if they're not going to make any more episodes, then where am I supposed to get my content from? My viewing pleasure.
I watch him as he drives.
That's a lovely thing from his book, isn't it? About how he used the same driver the whole time he was filming Poirot. He was a taxi driver on his first day. And that's really nice.
Or he's a cheapskate.
I like to think he paid him, but you never know, I suppose.
This is obviously going to be a show dedicated to the David Suchet Poirot TV show, which is the greatest TV show of all time.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a statement regarding that?
I agree entirely. Entirely seems to be the theme of the day. it's an undisputed fact, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Did you watch it from the beginning? Because you're quite a way younger than I am, so I'm not sure.
Yeah, I am about 400 years younger than you, mm-hmm. give or take.
So are all trees.
Count the rings. I was 3 when the series started.
Okay.
And so I came to it probably a bit later than, you know, because the whole, like, still struggling to keep my head upright and walk and all that kind of stuff, keeping me busy, occupying my time.
That comes back in life, by the way.
Oh, God, really?
Yeah.
Is that why you're, like, your head's walking, shaking around all over the place? like a bobblehead.
Yeah, so you discover beer. It's like you become an infant again.
Like a nodding dog.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I came to it late and then became obsessed with it as I think I grew up with it essentially from there, but obviously not from the beginning. So it was always on ITV, wasn't it, where we are in the UK. And I've always been interested in Agatha Christie because my dad had all the books and I had all the book covers and the spines and I just studied them all the time and just fascinated. And then after that whole learning to read thing really kicked off, I picked them up and read them and loved them. And yeah, and the rest is just a beginning of my love story with the show. Mm. How about you?
I'm very cool because I remember.
Oh, everyone knows that, of course. You are sat backwards on a chair right now. So.
Yeah, I'm sat upright. Can you believe it? I watched it when it first aired. It was 89 it was on, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So I was 13 and I watched the very first episode, Adventure of the Clapham Cook, on a Sunday evening. I think it was like 8 o'clock or something. And the next day, because I'm really very cool, I went into school and asked if any of my contemporaries had seen Poirot last night.
Hey, fellow kids.
Believe it or not, they had...
Skateboard under your arm, monocle.
Yeah. Galoshes in summer. So I was desperately, desperately uncool and watched Poirot. No one at school watched Poirot. But I remember watching The Dream, which I think is the last episode of Series 1.
Yeah.
And going into school, and I was like, please tell me someone watched The Dream. It was amazing. And no one had. So
surely the teachers were like, oh, I did.
Not you. So it's really nice after 80 years, whatever it was, when I was a child, to finally talk to someone about The Dream. I know we're 10 episodes away, but
it'd be a good episode.
Be quite a moment. Oh my God, it's such a good episode.
To do a mixture of French and Belgian, but I also need to speak English. So I listen to English-speaking Belgian radio, English-speaking French radio. Now, once I'd done that, I couldn't use my own voice. I mean, listen to my voice, it's down here. But Poirot is a head voice. So what I had to do was start with my voice down here, think a little bit about French accent or something like that, and talking, and then you have the guttural sounds of the Flemish here coming, and then you mix the Flemish with the French, and it sounds something like this, a little like that, but you raise your voice slightly, and it goes to the chest, and then it goes to the throat, and then you put in the little Belgian, a little French, up, 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 and there you are, you have Hercule Poirot.
So what's your favourite episode standout so far? Well, you know, from the whole series.
Oh, God.
What are you looking forward to seeing?
Well, hold on, just series one or just in the whole run of the whole
show? The whole thing.
God, it's so hard. Like, I mean, I don't have children, but they say it's like picking your favourite children, even though I'm fairly certain everyone's got a favourite, but anyway.
I have, yeah.
Do you, really? You have to tell, you can tell me off camera, off mic.
No, I'll tell you on camera. I'm joking. They won't listen to this anyway. It's not on TikTok.
I have a few favourites because there's such a rich catalogue. The writing is, everything's perfect about it, obviously, all the time. The writing, the acting, the sets, everything's just a dream. But yeah, the early ones, they are very special to me. I love things like Dumb Witness. That one is a cracker. Mainly because it's got a great dog in it as well, Bob.
Bob the dog.
Bob the dog.
Hastings, what make of dog is this?
Fox terrier.
And started David Touche's personal love affair with the wire hair fox terrier, I believe. He got one after.
I hope it wasn't like a personal love affair.
Why are you so judgmental about people's love? Just let him live. And he's a national treasure. He can do whatever he wants to whoever he wants.
That's why he's always travelling.
He's always escaping to his narrow boat to escape me. I'm paddling after him. Dumb Witness, some of the early ones. I actually rewatched Problem at Sea. God, that one is so good.
It's a doll.
Yes, a doll. Except this doll is an important witness to the truth of who killed Madame Clapperton.
They're all so good. And in the later ones, obviously, they get the production value. We'll talk about it as we go, of course, but the production value just increases and increases and the budgets go up and the actor names get bigger and bigger. So they become much more, feature film-esque, I suppose, in a lot of ways. But some of the later ones are great. I thought The Labours of Hercules our namesake to a degree, was really, really, really good, really haunting and creepy and dark. But there's so many, I can't even possibly. Your favourite is The Dream, you said?
Yeah, my favourite is The Dream, only because there's a real, really clever puzzle at the centre of it.
Yeah.
It's like a locked room mystery, sort of. Mm. How was this murder committed? And I remember sort of about halfway through thinking, oh, I've got the gestation of an idea. And it was like my little grey cells came to life and I managed to work it out. And I was like, I really hope this is right. And then I was right. And I was like, I'm so proud of myself. I'm so pleased with that. And then I just fell in love with all Agatha Christie stories after that, because I was like, oh, I need to solve them, see if I can do it. And I don't manage it many times, I'll be honest with you.
I have the same dream night after night. I'm sitting in my room next to this, sitting at my desk writing. There's a clock in there. I look up at it. I see the time. It is exactly 28 minutes past 12. Always the same time. You understand? When I see the time, Poirot, I know I've got to do it. At 28 minutes past 12, I open the second drawer down on the right of my desk. I take out a revolver. I load it. Then I go over to the window.
And then?
I shoot myself. I just lift the gun to my head and shoot myself.
Because you can't, no one can match her genius. She was unbelievable brain.
She gets the balance so right between giving you the clues you need and obscuring them enough so that they're not impossible to. She's unsurpassed.
Yeah, she's quite good, Agatha Christie.
Yeah, she's all right.
She's pretty good. Yeah, yeah. Sold quite a few copies and all that. She's pretty.
It's like 40,000 books she's sold now, isn't it?
Yeah. Like one of the biggest selling authors of all time, I think.
I'm kidding. It's like 4 billion, isn't it? 4 billion books.
Something. Yeah. I know, you were joking. She's the best.
You said, do you remember her books as well?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I have them all, obviously, and yeah, read them. And obviously, the cover art as well.
This is what I was going to say. Mm-hmm. The cover art for me when I was growing up was that I used to see Agatha Christie books in bookshops and in secondhand shops and places, and they were always like these really disturbing visual images, like a skull with a spider coming out of the eye, or like, you know, a shot through a drink or something, and then there's a dagger on the side. And I remember those books and the Alfred Hitchcock books being that kind of same horrible imagery as a child. So those two names for me were always really sinister as I was growing up. And it's only since, you know, reading them and exploring them and watching his films and things that you realise.
Well, it's Tom Adams as the artist, wasn't it, behind a lot of her later covers in the 70s covers. Like, they're terrifying. And they're so, like, and the stories themselves. So that's the thing about Agatha Christie, and one of the reasons why it continues to be such a big hit all over the world is because it's a murder show you can watch in a Sunday afternoon, and your whole family can watch it. And it's, you know, it's scary to a degree, but it's family friendly. There's no blood. Mm. Even in the books, there's really no blood. It doesn't ever get gory or gratuitous in any sort of way. So the covers were, you think, holy, we're not going to swear on this podcast, are we? Probably shouldn't. I'm not used to being censored on my one. I have a mouth like a sailor. So I'll be good.
Well, that's a good way to tee you up then. So why don't you tell everyone who you are and what else you do?
Okay. Hi, everyone. You've been listening to me ramble already. My name is Frankie. I have another podcast that I do as well called The Red and Buried Podcast, where I host it with my dear friend Sarah, and we talk about crime books and we speak to authors and just generally chat a lot of rubbish and with very lowbrow reviews of very well-written books, probably is the best way to describe it.
Oh, I'd say highbrow, definitely. I love your show.
That's very kind. Well, obviously, I'm a huge fan of your hundreds of shows that you do and hundreds of pieces of content you put out all the time. And I'm going to say, Adam, why don't you introduce yourself? But everyone probably knows who you are already if they're listening to this.
It'd be silly.
But do it anyway. For fun.
Well, I'm Adam, and I created the Secret History of Hollywood podcast. That's my main gig. and the Attaboy Clarence podcast, which is like my side gig. And I'm a quarter of the House of Hammer, and I'm on a show called All the Best Lines, and I do writing and things. It's like I'm around in all kinds of different media. But yeah, anyway, I hate having an inactive brain.
Well, I don't think you could if you tried.
Well, I'm now half of this show as well, The Labours of Hercule.
Very excited.
Which, as you said, takes its name from the mini-series, I want to call it a mini-series, of stories she did. It was in the collection, wasn't it? I think it was like 10 stories.
Yeah.
But I remember when they were nearing the end of the run with David Suchet, and they were like, we've only got 3 stories left. And I remember thinking, no, you've got Labours of Hercules is like 10, and then you've got Curtain, then you've got Big Four and stuff. And I was thinking, no, there's loads left. And then they very cleverly combined all 10 stories, didn't they, into like one...
mega story.
Episode, full-length episode.
Yeah.
And I remember being really trepidatious by it, because I loved The Labours of Hercules. I think that was a great collection of stories, and I was thinking, oh, they don't miss them out, but they were very, very wise with what they did.
Oh, 100%. Mm. Yeah, the last episodes, although heartbreaking to have to sit through, because it meant the end, but they were so well done. And it's just, yeah, and that's the thing, even though I've read The Labours of Hercules, watching it was a completely different experience, but in a positive way, which is so rare with an adaptation of something that you love, that you actually really love it and enjoy it. And it's perfectly done.
That's the thing about this series. The quality never dips, does it?
No.
Even like the first series, which is 10 episodes.
Yeah.
And they're all under an hour. And they obviously, there were a lot of Poirot short stories. So it was, yeah, rich pickings in terms of stories to tell. But like I said, even the early ones, I mean, if anything, the early ones are kind of more beautiful in a way. They're not as slick.
Yeah.
They're very well produced. And because they were done in the 80s, you were only like 50 years outside of the time they were set. So most of the architecture and streets and everything don't look modern at all, so they were still a bit untouched.
And that's the thing. And there are some sets that are still, some buildings and things they use that are still around and still with that beautiful Art Deco architecture. Like Surbiton Station, which features in Adventures of the Clapham Kirk, which is quite near where I live. So that's always exciting when I go past that on the train.
And Clapham Common, just over the road from the house in this, the house. I mean, when he rocks up to the house in the car, and they go through the gate and into the house. I mean, the just even the wall decorations and the tiling on the floor and everything, you can tell it's a holdover from Victorian times. That's like, oh, I love it so much.
and you make a good point as well, because I read in his book that the first series, they spent $5 million on the first 10 episodes, which was especially for the 80s. That's like what today's money, like £500 billion or something. I'm not good with currency, but something like that.
If you go by today's currency, it might be about 30 quid.
Yeah, that's true. But yeah, you can see that it's so rich, and just the everything about it is just perfect. I think his budget, the majority of the budget went on his moustaches for the first 10 episodes as well, because so rich and textured.
Well, I suppose we better say a word about the recurring cast that we're going to see at least for the next 40-something episodes. Obviously, the man himself, David Suchet. I mean, what a perfect piece of casting. I mean, it's like he was born to play that part. What do you think of him?
So this is the thing. There have been so many portrayals of Poirot on the screen, and they've all been fine.
I know you're particularly fond of Kenneth Branagh, aren't you?
You said we weren't going to swear on this podcast. best we don't. I don't get into that that dark, dark period in our history. But let's go back to the originals, like Albert Finney, Peter Ustinov. Like, they're all good in their own way, but David Suchet is the definitive Hercule Poirot, I think, in terms of the way that Agatha Christie wrote him, the look of him, the way everything. He did his research, and you can tell.
Oh my God, yes.
Yeah.
Even down to the pound coin.
You're going to have to explain the pound coin for people that don't know.
Well, in his book, Poirot and Me, he talks about how he perfected the Poirot walk, which he describes as a mince.
I think she did in her book as well, the mince.
Yeah, I think it's like Poirot mince. It's very quick steps, legs close together. And he said he achieved it consistently by inserting a pound coin between his bum cheeks and keeping it there and walking around. And if you think about it, it's like pretty genius.
It is.
Because even when he was walking up and downstairs, he had to walk a certain way to keep it there. Otherwise, you would have heard a clink.
Ding.
Poirot's walk was so famous, and you had an unusual way with a coin of getting that. A little technique.
You have a wonderful way of putting it. Now, I actually put a coin in between the cheeks of my buttock and walked in a way that I couldn't let the coin drop. Detailed and descriptive in the book.
Wow.
So he crossed the lawn in his rapid mincing gait.
That was the line,
so
isn't it?
I had to try and find that to keep it in the character of Poirot as well.
So if anybody's trying to imitate it, then get a coin and slip it
pop
down
it
your buttocks and see how you get on.
I wouldn't recommend it.
Just never ask David Suchet if he has change, because give it a rinse first or something. But no, clearly worth every penny.
All 100 of them.
Exactly. Yeah, no, he's perfect.
There's a thing, when it comes to Sherlock Holmes, for instance, people say that Basil Rathbone is the ideal Holmes, and he definitely, if you think of Holmes, you think of at least that sort of image. But they say that Jeremy Brett is the purist's version, because not only did he look like him, he kind of, you know, he's more faithful to the character. I think that you can't fault David Suchet's Poirot one bit. He looks exactly like he's described.
Yes.
And it's weird to say, but it's almost like he's better than Agatha Christie's description of the way Poirot acts. It's like,
he's too good to be true.
Yeah, it's incredible.
I actually have a description of him here from Agatha Christie's book, where he says, "I am 5 feet 4 inches high. My head, it is egg-shaped, and I carry it a little to one side, the left. My eyes, I am told, shine green." That's the only thing that's different, because he had brown, very dark eyes, David Suchet. "Shine green when I'm excited." So cute. "My boots are patent leather, smart and shiny. My stick is embossed with a gold band." Actually, I think a stick is silver in the series. So, filling holes.
Forget everything I've just said then.
Cancel this stupid podcast, what a waste. "My watch is large and keeps my time exactly. My moustache is the finest in all London."
Very true.
See, that, and hard to argue that.
Perfection.
Then I was approached by the producer, Brian Eastman, and I was asked if I had read a lot of or any of Agatha Christie, and to my shame, I said no. And he said, "Have you heard of a character called Hercule Poirot?" And I said, "Oh, yes, I've seen him on the screen, Peter Ustinov, Albert Finney." And he said, "Well, we're really seriously considering making a series. Would you like to do it? And you are our first choice." And gradually one thing led to another, and I got the books and I started reading, and I rang my brother John, who I know is here tonight, because he's always wise, my older brother. And I said, "Do you know Agatha Christie?" He said, "Yes, of course I know Agatha Christie. Do you know Hercule Poirot?" "Yes, of course I know Hercule Poirot. But should I?" "I've just been offered the possibility of playing it, and I just wondered what you would think." And he said, "What?" I said, "Well, I just wondered what you might think of it." He said, "Oh, God, don't touch it with a barge pole." The moral of that story, never listen to your elder brother.
And then, obviously, playing his loyal friend, Captain Hastings, the marvellous Hugh Fraser.
Amazing.
Again, it's like you couldn't ask for anyone more perfect, really, could you?
No.
I've seen lots of Hastings in different things, and they're all kind of, they're a bit too rough and tumble, and you could say that Hugh Fraser plays it a little bit Nigel Bruce-ish and like a little bit bumbling, maybe, but I think it makes him more lovable. I don't mind a bumbling sidekick, because it's nice to have the clever one explain things to him sometimes so that you get that.
But he's meant to represent us, right? The people, the dum-dums watching. They're like, what does it all mean, Poirot? But I think the reason why it works so well, that Hugh Fraser plays it so well, is because he is bumbling and he's quite stupid, and definitely, we'll get into it in future episodes, definitely is distracted very easily by women. But he plays his bumblingness straight. He's not doing it for comedic effect. There is a comedic effect, but it's so genuine, his kind of, his awe and surprise and, you know, learning of what's happening. It's all very, it feels very authentic with him, I think. And he's such a gentleman.
Yeah, he is. That's the crucial thing as well, because of the era it's set, you can tell he has had military service as well. So he's he's got this aura about him. He's refined and he likes what he likes and he likes cars. And you
know, what a lad.
Yeah, he's a proper lad. The Poirot mysteries do require a certain element of physicality sometimes, and it's great to have Hugh Fraser playing Captain Hastings for those moments where someone needs to be chased down, or you know, or they need a fast car, or yeah, there's a problem to be solved, and Poirot doesn't want to get his gloves dirty or something like that. So,
or his boot, his shoes, his shiny shoes. Yeah, no, and Hastings all tall, and yeah, he can run, and he loves driving. Poirot hates driving. They're polar opposites, but it's so well balanced, isn't it?
Like they love each other.
Such
as
a
well,
rich. Even when Poirot is saying something incredibly cutting. Mm-hmm. And judgmental of him, you can tell it's done with love, and it's almost like out of a disappointed parent when Hastings says something really stupid. It's like, but it, there is, for sake, but the love is there, and yeah, and it's yeah reciprocated clearly. We stan them. Is that what the kids say?
And scrambled eggs, was it?
Mais certainement. The little sausages.
Oh yes, sir.
Devilled kidneys.
Kidneys, yes. What about bacon?
Crisp.
Of course. And tea. Or a nice pint of home brew.
Beer? For breakfast?
2 pints, please.
But Hastings, we've got to be back before 12.
Plenty of time.
And then we go to the other occupant of Whitehaven Mansions, which is Miss Lemon, played by Pauline Moran, who terrified me as a child because she played the original Woman in Black in the 89. Same year as well. What a year for her.
Wow. Great year.
Yeah, God. She played the Woman in Black in the TV adaptation of that, which was remains to this day the most terrifying thing I've ever seen in my life.
It is truly terrifying. I've seen it.
Oh, God. But yeah, so she plays Miss Lemon, who is not only Poirot's secretary, but also a crossover character from another Agatha Christie series. Did you know that?
I didn't know that I did.
She played the secretary to Mr. Parker Pyne.
Also.
Same character, yes. And then she went to work for Mr. Poirot.
Well, when you've got a character as strong as Miss Lemon, you might as well get everything you can out of her, get your money's worth, because, yeah, she's amazing. And she's a secretary, and she sorts his life out, and she keeps him in check, and keeps his ego in check a lot of the time. And also,
she does.
Much needed.
She's very withering. She's probably the only one, actually. He can fire something at her, and she can just take him down as well.
Yeah, 100%.
Like, whoa.
And she's a little bit brighter than Hastings, I think. He appreciates, which is probably why he takes it from her, because she's smart enough to do it.
Poor Hastings.
Poor Hastings. He's got a lot of other strengths. Mm. He can drive.
That's it.
We obviously love Hastings, but yeah, Miss Lemon and him have a unique relationship, and she knows he's insane and weird, and he's got his little quirks and things, and she's just totally accepting of it to a degree. And she's quite fastidious herself in a lot of ways, you know, organized and meticulous. And
yeah, her main mission in life is to develop the perfect filing system.
So, what a noble mission.
She does over the course of the series.
Oh, spoilers. God, I'm sorry.
No. That's her character arc, ruined.
It's nearly complete, you see. My system. Every one of your cases classified and cross-referenced 5 different ways.
5?
Oh, yes. In this cabinet, names of witnesses. In this, name of perpetrator, if known. Victim's trade or profession. Type of case. Abduction, addiction, adultery, see also under marriage. Bigamy, see also under marriage. Bonds.
See also under marriage.
And what about the last one?
Yeah, you tell us about him.
Inspector Japp.
This is the coolest thing we get to talk about this.
I know, I'm not lost on me how exciting this is.
Tell you what, we should totally record this and make a podcast then.
Oh, I see you're making a joke, it's very funny.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Sorry, I'm slow. I'm the Hastings of this duo, really. Yeah, so what do you think of Inspector Japp? I've talked loads about my gushing of all of them. I've gushed all over them. That sounded terrible.
Philip Jackson. That's what I love about this whole thing. It's the 4 main characters who anchor it are just so likable.
Yes.
So, but as well, they don't just start off a certain way and stay there. Like, they develop in incredible ways as the series goes on. There's a really fantastic episode. I can't remember the name of the story right now, but there's one where Japp goes on a speaking tour.
Yes, yes.
And he's talking about his past cases.
Yes.
And Poirot is really upset by it because, you know, why is he going out telling people he's claimed all my gigs. And then I won't spoil it because we'll get to that episode. But there's a certain moment in it where Jap reveals a certain truth about his career to an auditorium. And it's one of the most beautiful moments ever. Suchet is completely annoyed and angry and about to leave. And then he hears this thing that he's saying. And it's like, oh, they're like a little family.
They are completely, yeah. And that's the thing with, and it's the classic kind of trope with these kinds of things where you've got a detective that's not a part of the police force, but they're coming in and they're solving murders. And it's like, it's that thing of the police often, and Hastings to a degree, Jap to a degree is a little bit like, oh, for heaven's sake, can you keep your nose out of this, Poirot? Jesus, we're trying to do our police work. But respect him infinitely and recognises his genius and knows that actually he needs him a lot of the time with a bit of reluctance. He loves to tease him as well. Like, they have a really good teasing relationship between the two of them, I would say, because, it's fun. It's all in good humour because Jap is also the most British man on the planet. Like,
he's working class as well.
Yeah.
Whereas the others aren't really, are they, apart from his
No, name. That's true, actually. I hadn't considered that.
He's like bangers and mash guy and, you know, he's got an old raincoat and big old moustache and pipe and things like that. And the rest of it, I think he likes visiting their world almost.
Oh.
Ascending to the heavens. Whitehaven Mansion.
There's an episode later on. I think it's, which one is it? That's going to drive me crazy. But it's the one where he stays at Poirot's flat for a while.
Ooh.
And he uses the bidet. He doesn't know what it's for. And he's like washing his face with the bidet. And Poirot's horrified when he tells him. It's so good. And also, I think that same episode, he's like, oh, we're going to have, I'll make you spotted dick or something. And Poirot is like,
spotted dick.
Truly disgusted.
What's that thing in the bathroom, Poirot?
Come on.
Like a foot bath.
The bidet.
Oh, bidet. It's got a sort of fountain thing in the middle. What's that for?
It is of no significance.
Nearly got a squirt in the eye when I turned it on.
It is best not to tamper with it, Chief Inspector. It is broken. I will get the food.
Must say, I'm looking forward to this, Miss Lemon.
You look like a man in need of his dinner, Chief Inspector.
That thing in the bathroom, though.
It is best not to bother Miss Lemon with the deficiencies of our plumbing, Chief Inspector.
And also, there's a great episode called The Chocolate Box where they go to Belgium together, don't they? Because Jap's going to receive this award.
Yeah.
And you watch him totally change, like, all the way through. He's like, Poirot, Poirot. But as well, you don't ever get the sense that Jap's a stupid policeman. You get the feeling like he figures things out for himself, and he's a very successful man because he's solved lots of cases.
Yeah.
So there is a mutual respect for their different skill sets. But when he goes to Belgium to collect this award and Poirot goes with him, he turns into this, almost going like that, and he sort of straightens up. And everyone he meets is like, hello, sir, it's very good to meet. And you're like, oh, that's such a great character. I mean, and so perfectly performed by Philip Jackson. I'd say, he's definitely...
Because he's so, as you say, he's likable through his stiffness. It's just, it's a delightful performance.
He's always mentioned fourth, isn't he? You know, in that list of four recurring characters. But I mean, you couldn't do the series without any of them, really.
No.
And when they do disappear later on, in the more modern series, it does feel slightly emptier, I would say.
There's a loss.
But even though the mysteries are great, the stories are great, David Suchet is always great, and the guest stars they have are fantastic. But I was so over the moon when they brought them all back. For the big four, I was like, oh.
They had to for the last ones. That's one of the things I love about the TV, the early episodes in particular, is that often, like, Jap is written into a story that he's not in the book, but it's great because you're always happy to see Inspector Jap.
Yeah.
So I'll take, write him into everything. In every show, not even Poirot, just write him into every show ever, and I'd be very, very happy.
Yep, they should put him into everything. Game of Thrones, Simpsons, everything.
He'd be great in The Simpsons. And interesting, I think David Suchet said before, before he played Poirot, he actually played Inspector Jap, I think, in another adaptation, which is like, that is mind-boggling. That's so wrong.
Yeah, I remember seeing that, actually. And
oh, really?
Yeah, I remember thinking, this is, I don't like it. Stop it.
Wrong. No.
Get out.
My poor Jap, I'm afraid your presentation of the case revolts the intelligence.
It doesn't revolt mine. Oh, I've got to get back to her flat. I've got a few more questions for her ladyship now.
Hastings and I will accompany you.
I don't want you to.
It's on our way.
I don't...
Resign yourself to the fact that from now on, everywhere you go is on our way.
We should probably actually talk about the very first episode now.
Let's do that.
So much. this thing, we could talk about this. I could just chat about the elements of it forever without going to any specific episodes.
Just gushing over them, like, as you say. Mm.
Mm. Yeah, ruining his suit with all the gushing.
Well, we're going to have plenty of opportunities to do that, because I think there are a couple of episodes of this.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, thank you so much for doing this, because I put a call out on social media a little while ago. I was watching them on a Sunday afternoon, and I was thinking, oh, God, words cannot express how much I love this show. So I wonder if anyone would want to make a Poirot podcast, but not a Poirot podcast. I want to do it specifically about the David Suchet TV series, because there are far more learned, but I didn't really want to go back to the books and that kind of thing. But I've seen every episode, must be 20 times each. And your name was quickly mentioned. It was like, oh, speak to Frankie. So we got in touch, and we've since become very good friends. I can't believe how perfect you are for this show, because you are the biggest Poirot nut.
Thank you.
I've ever met.
Well, yeah, first of all, going back to you put this tweet out, and I think you basically summoned me. You basically went into a dark room, said my name 3 times in a mirror and turned off the light, and then I appeared because you tweeted out saying, I want to do a podcast about Poirot, specifically David Suchet's Poirot. And I think, and I was scared that you thought I'd hired some bots to just spam you with my name, because all of my lovely friends on Twitter, I'll give a shout out to Jamie Smart in particular, because he was the first one to be like, I think this is you he's talking about. And then a few other people are like, oh my God, Frankie, you've got to do this. So I then emailed you and tried not to sound too insane, which is hard given my level of obsession with Poirot.
Also hard because you were in the ceiling of David Suchet's house at the time.
The Wi-Fi is not good up there, you know. but yeah, it was it's all worked out beautifully from my perspective. I'm very excited and honored that you'd let me even talk about this.
This is like, you know, such a dream to do, and you are such a dream to do it with. So I'm over the moon.
It's very kind. Well, likewise, God. No, I'm thrilled, and as you've alluded to, I'm quite into Poirot. I'm like totally casual about it. It's not really a big deal. I have a few Poirot tattoos. I walked down the aisle at my wedding to the theme music, because it is the greatest theme music of all time. That's a whole conversation.
I mean, we've got plenty of opportunities to discuss the music. Oh, can't wait.
Oh, and the credits and God. I've been to see him a couple of times, casually, like totally cool, not weird about it at all. And I have, all the books, obviously, and just generally anything with Poirot's face or whatever, David Suchet's Poirot specifically, I will probably own or put on my body in some way, at least. So,
have you ever thought about having a Poirot moustache tattoo?
Yeah, 100%.
Have you?
You're considering my foreign heritage, you'd think naturally I could probably grow one, but turns out no, which is a disappointment that I face every day. I've had to settle for a couple of them tattooed up on my person, not on my face, because I just think I couldn't pull it off in the same way that he does. But maybe one day, maybe as I age, I'll grow one.
You should pay tribute and wax your eyebrows or something.
Oh, yeah? You think I could? I mean, we can talk about his moustache. That's a whole other thing as well, is the evolution of Poirot's moustache.
Shall I, as a challenge, grow a moustache from this moment until our last episode?
Yes.
And slowly shape it into a Poirot moustache.
Nothing would make me happier. I feel like you could get some tips from your friend Kev. He's got a cracking moustache.
Yeah, that's very true. Ooh.
Maybe he could give you some guidance.
Well, I think
some offcuts.
It might. He's got very different colour hair to me, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And
to Poirot.
It might look good. I might just not tell them. See what they say, because we do speak regularly on Zoom calls.
Mm.
They say, "What's that moustache talking about? What is that this?"
Can you dye it dark as well?
Yeah. Okay.
Great.
You literally want me to do this?
Yeah, 100%. No, you've committed to it now, and everybody knows. And
okay.
Can't wait to watch the progress.
Yeah, me too. We're trying to grow a moustache for 40 years and it hasn't worked so well.
But now you have a purpose. Maybe that's what it's needed this whole time.
There's going to be that period, though, where I look...
Yeah, it's just the price you've got to pay. You can't go near schools, but you're going to look so sharp.
And what do I win if I do this, by the way?
Adoration and respect.
Oh, that's what I've always wanted. So good answer.
Because you haven't got any of that already, so unfortunately.
Yeah, don't like it.
Thank you.
first episode, which aired in 1989, January the 8th.
Cast your minds back.
Yes.
I was three.
I was...
You were... How old are you? 42?
I was at my retirement party when this was on.
What were the dinosaurs like, Adam? You're not even old. I feel old. I feel a lot older than I am. That's one of the things I think why Poirot resonates with me and Agatha Christie resonates with me, because I feel like an old lady. I feel like Miss Marple.
Well, you've very kindly showed me the house that you and your husband are buying.
Yes.
And it does have a bit of a Christie vibe.
It's a 30s house. Yes. Mm, cannot wait.
Very cool.
I'm going to
install myself into your ceiling. Anyway, the first episode, which aired on January the 8th, 1989, was
yes.
The Adventure of the Clapham Cook.
Yes.
Do you want to do a brief run-through of the plot?
I feel like you should do it because your voice is so much better than mine, but give it a go.
Well, we'll just do the IMDb tagline for the episode. Do you know it?
Not off the top of my head.
Okay, why not? Call yourself a fan.
My commitment. I know, I'm so sorry.
Well, I've got it here. The IMDb description is, Poirot probes the disappearance of a wealthy woman's cook and soon uncovers an elaborate plot to hide an even darker crime.
That is a good description.
A very good description, actually. So, where do you want to start?
The beginning.
Go on, then.
It's a very good description. Well, I think the one thing missing from that, the synopsis, is basically the very, very beginning of it. I mean, you see a man very... nefariously tying up a trunk with rope, and he's really pulling it, and you're like, oh, is he strangling someone? What's he doing? No, he's just tying a trunk up. But then it cuts to, you see Whitehaven Mansions for the first time in all its glory, Poirot's beautiful apartment building where he lives. Stunning art deco design. We could talk about the curves of that building for...
Something about that building, isn't it?
I mean, it's bordering on erotic. I should probably stop. Reel that in.
Smoosh my body against it.
Mm-hmm.
Just all the way.
You remember this is an audio medium, right?
Thank God.
But it's a beautiful building, and it opens up with Poirot and Hastings. And Hastings is going through the paper, trying to find a case to entice Poirot. Because he's had a bit of a lull lately in his caseload, and nothing's inspiring him. It's all boring, and he's fed up, and he wants something good. And he's got a long list of tasks that he needs to do. Important stuff like, you know, pomade his moustache, get his suit cleaned, all the essential stuff that, you know, a man about town needs to have done.
Well, as I know, yeah, I'm always getting my collars and cuffs done.
And you're going to know soon with your moustache. It's very exciting. Can't wait to see that.
Me too. Can't wait to go on all the registers.
Yeah, I'd say you can't take your kids to school, but they're too old for school anyway now, so you're fine.
Yeah, it's one saving grace.
Mysterious suicide, absconding bank clerk, missing typist.
Yes, but I am not greatly attracted to any of them, mon ami. I have many affairs of importance of my own to attend to.
Such as?
My wardrobe, Hastings. If I mistake not, there is on my new grey suit the spot of grease. You have noticed it, perhaps, eh?
No.
No? Well, it's only the one spot, you understand, but it is sufficient to trouble me. Then there is my winter overcoat. I must lay him aside in the powder of Keating's. And I think the moment is ripe for the trimming of the moustache.
And then, basically, he gets a visit from a very angry little woman, Mrs. Todd.
So glad you described her like that, not me. I would have had letters. You can't describe women that way.
You are so cancelled. No, Mrs. Todd, I think if anybody watches the episode, we'll see that Mrs. Todd is not the most pleasant of women. So I don't think she represents womankind in general. But she comes in and she basically wants him to help find her missing cook. And Poirot is a little bit dismissive at first, a little bit snobby. He does have his snobby elements to him because he's the great Hercule Poirot.
Famously, yes.
Yes. So why would he waste his time finding a domestic cook? And she makes a very impassioned speech about how a cook is just as valuable as anything, as diamonds, I think, or something like that, she says.
I'll tell you what I want you to do for me. I want you to find my cook.
I fear you are making a mistake, madame. Hercule Poirot is a private detective.
I know that. Haven't I just told you I want you to find my cook for me? Walked out of the house on Wednesday without so much as a by your leave and never came back.
I am sorry, madame, but I do not touch that particular kind of business. I wish you good day.
There's a beautiful moment, actually, when he, because he does dismiss her, he just,
yes.
Hastings has just said something along the lines of, well, there's a jewel robbery, there's a heist thing that's happened. He's like, no, no, no. she throws it back at him and says, a good cook's a good cook, and you're very high and mighty.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a beautiful moment where he sort of stiffens, you know, takes the insult on board.
Yeah.
And it just, like, melts him, doesn't it?
Mm.
It's a beautiful moment. He's so good.
He's so good. And this is the thing, and that's why I think his Poirot is so perfect in his representation of it, because Poirot is vastly superior to all of us. That's just a fact. He just is, because he's so intelligent and he's so worldly and, you know, his genius is visible. But he's not rude. He is not a rude man. He's all about manners and proper etiquette and decorum. And I think he recognised in that moment that he was being a bit of a dick.
Yeah, it's like, I don't deal with this kind of business. I'm really sorry that's hurt you.
Yeah.
Let me apologise. And yeah,
yeah.
It's like you say, that's a very well-written character. And it's very well played as well. It's not...
Yeah.
He's not a caricature at all.
No.
You do imagine he's going to be at the beginning where he's doing, no, no, and he's sitting there and thinking, but he humanises himself at every opportunity.
I am sorry, madame, but I do not touch that particular kind of business. I wish you good day.
So that's it, is it? Too proud, eh? Only deal with government secrets and countess's jewels? Well, let me tell you, Mr. High and Mighty Poirot, a good cook's a good cook. And when you lose one, it's as much to you as pearls are to some fine lady.
Madame, you are in the right and I am in the wrong. Your remarks are just and intelligent. This case would be a novelty, Hastings. Never before have we hunted a missing domestique. Truly, here is the problem of national importance. Wonderful. Where do you reside, Mrs. Dodd?
88 Prince Albert Road to Clapham.
And that's David Suchet, I think, bringing that in particular.
Yeah,
because,
definitely.
You watch Albert Finney, you watch Peter Ustinov's adaptations, and they're just quite mean as Poirots. They're very dismissive, they're judgy, people, and they know that they're smarter than everyone, and they're quite happy to say it in a very brash way. Whereas Poirot is all about, he speaks to people of all classes in every episode, and he's, you know, polite and warm to a fault. Unless someone's rude to him, like, he will treat everyone with the utmost respect, and he respects human life. That's the whole point. And I think that's the warmth that David Suchet brings to that, to his character.
Demonstrated many times in this first series, especially.
Yes.
It's always the servants or the housemaids, the house help and the staff.
Yes.
That he charms, first of all, especially in this episode. He always charms them. Gets the most information out of them, treats them like people instead of servants or pets like the owners of the houses do.
Yes.
And as well, he's an ex-policeman. He didn't come from money or anything. He's not upper class.
No.
Just a very polite, well-ordered man who knows what he likes. Definitely a hint of OCD there.
Just a smidge, yeah.
Just a little tiny bit.
But also I think as a ex-policeman, he knows that if you want to get the information that you need out of people, you know, particularly the servants and things in the houses are the ones that see everything. They're the ones with all the information. The way to get that is to be nice to people and to be engaging and warm and build a rapport with people instead of just demanding and shouting questions at them. He knows you get a better response. Like, and in this episode, we get onto it in a bit, but he speaks to Annie, the maid, and she basically falls for him big time. He flatters her. And she says some silly things, but he totally indulges her, and he gets everything he needs as a result.
Sit yourself.
Thank you, sir.
All that you shall tell us will be of the greatest importance, Annie. You alone can shed any light on the case. Without you, I can do nothing.
Oh, sir, I'm sure I'll tell you anything I can, sir.
That is good. Now, first of all, what is your own idea? You are a girl of remarkable intelligence that can be seen at once. But this is a queer thing, eh? What is your own explanation of Eliza's disappearance?
White slaver, sir. Ah. I've said so all along, sir. Only no one will listen. Cook was always warning me against them. Don't you go sniffing no scent nor eating no sweets, no matter how gentlemanly the fellow.
This is something we had not thought of, Hastings.
No. Right. Good heavens.
He knows people, and you can tell.
It happens again in the next episode, actually.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that. But again, it's always the kids playing in the street or the understairs staff that provide the vital clue. And whereas Jap is always a man who's sort of, right then, my lad, you know, is always chest puffed out, using his power and authority to get what he wants. Generally, that kind of approach doesn't work with anyone, even in this episode. Hastings does a bit of chest puffing out when he speaks to the porter near the end of the episode.
Yes.
And gets like, we'll get to him. But yeah. Anyway, to continue with the plot, I think Poirot takes the case of the missing cook because he feels bad for having insulted Mrs. Todd.
Yes.
Goes to her house and instantly begins to recognise that something is wrong in the house, not just the missing cook. There seems to be some kind of, something's not sitting right with him, especially in the room of her paying guest, lodger, Mr. Simpson.
Mr. Simpson. I'm trying to do my little accent.
Mr. Simpson.
Very offensive to the people listening. I can only apologise for our French-Belgian listeners.
There are many. Anyway, so he goes to the house, discovers that something is up in the room of Mr. Simpson, who works at a bank. And upon further investigation, Poirot uncovers the fact that one of his co-workers at the bank, Mr. Davis... Yeah, Mr. Davis has disappeared with £50,000 of securities.
Which, in today's currency, is approximately...
30 quid, yeah.
Exactly.
Ah, my dear Chief Inspector Gerard.
After the reward, eh, Poirot?
Oh, no. No, I am engaged on quite a different case.
And what would this different case be, then?
Ah, well, now, there is such a thing as client confidentiality, Chief Inspector. Let me just say that this case I am engaged on is of national importance.
Well, I'm glad to hear it, Poirot. Someone was trying to tell me you'd gone into the missing domestics business.
No, I said. Not Poirot, I said. Hard times or not, he wouldn't fall that far.
Can't really say much more about the plot without spoiling it.
This is the thing. I don't know how deep we want to go into it. But I do want to mention there is a moment when he's speaking to Mr. Todd where Poirot gets uncomfortably close to him.
Oh, Mr. Simpson, you mean?
Sorry, Mr. Todd's the husband.
I was going to say, there is a great scene with Mr. Todd. He just sits down and pours himself a drink and they're both going...
You see Hastings' heart break visibly on the screen. The exact moment, like in The Simpsons, where his heart breaks and there's no drink for him. Yeah, that is true. But the bit I was thinking about is Mr. Simpson when he goes up to him and he's basically like nose to nose with him practically.
Like 1 inch from full sex.
Yeah, and he from kissing. And he asks him about his, if he's done amateur dramatics or something. Have you been in the theatre? And he's like, no.
Tell me, Mr. Simpson, what does a young fellow find to do around here of an evening, huh?
Oh, the usual things, you know.
Oh, with musical evenings, amateur theatricals, that kind of thing?
Yes, I suppose so.
But you do not interest yourself, hmm?
Afraid not.
No. Thank you.
It's very left field. And also, Suchet plays that again as another perfect moment where he sort of looks at him and sort of goes to turn, but then looks back. And it's very subtle.
Yeah.
But it's very perfectly played. You can tell that he's noticed something.
Mm.
Then he asks him this really strange question. How much of dramatics?
But again, see, that's obviously quite a significant part of the narrative. And Agatha Christie makes sure that, you know, in the writing and in the adaptation, they make sure you notice it because you're not going to forget David Suchet Eskimo kissing a man.
Well, you haven't.
Well, clearly, I'm just very jealous. But yeah, it's a fun moment. And yeah, there's so many fun little moments like that. I mean, you could easily dismiss it. It's like, oh, it's so quirky, my goodness. But it's nothing's ever... Everything that Poirot does is meticulously calculated and it's for the gain of knowledge and insight. And that's why it's so good. God damn, he's good.
So he is, god damn it.
God damn.
The first clue comes from Annie, the housemaid, as we say. She describes the events leading up to the disappearance of the cook, who just vanished one day, sent for her things. So the mystery then becomes, what happened to Mr. Davis and his £50,000 of securities? What happened to the cook and why did she go in the middle of the night? And how are the two things linked? It seems to be through Mr. Simpson, but we don't know how.
Yeah.
And that is the mystery.
And that's where... Also, the crossover happens because in the book, Jap isn't in the book.
Right.
But he's mentioned in the book because he says, please don't tell Inspector Jap that I'm investigating a disappeared cook, because that's, you know, far too inferior for the likes of me. And then he goes to the bank and Jap sees him. And you can see the amusement on his face where he's like, ha, It's true. I've heard rumour that you're investigating the disappearance of a cook, and Poirot tries to hide himself. Oh, so good. But there is that overlap with the bank, and then that's when, you know, as they alluded to in the synopsis that you read, there's something darker going on.
Yes, there is. And it turns out that there's an even more insidious crime that's taken place that connects the two things together.
And arguably the most insidious crime of all is there's a moment where, I'm not going to spoil too much, but do we go on and talk about the fact that they do find the cook?
Yeah, well, I think it's fair to say Poirot solves what happens to the... This is all done in 45 minutes, because the genius of these earlier episodes is that they crammed entire stories down to, you know, an hour with breaks. So that's about 45 minutes. But yeah, I mean, Poirot, of course he wins the day. You find out what's happened to the cook.
Yeah.
You find out what's happened to the securities. You find out what's happened to Mr. Davis. And you find out how Mr. Simpson is involved in everything.
Shockingly genius. Of course it is, because it's from the mind of Agatha Christie. But the bit I was referring to, probably the worst crime in the whole episode, is when the cook is basically explaining that she disappeared because an Australian lawyer approached her and told her that she was entitled to a house in Keswick and a lot of money. But she can't be in domestic service in order to get these things. So that's one of the reasons why she disappears. But the biggest crime of all is this guy's Australian accent, because Jesus Christ, it's absolutely terrible.
Now, mister, to business. I do have to tell you that the house is in Keswick.
Ah, that's just over by Acton, isn't it, sir?
Now, Miss Dunn, it's in the north of England, near Carlisle.
Oh, my good God.
But before we confront that particular difficulty, there is one other stipulation that we should get out of the way.
Whatever's that, sir?
Well, it's of no importance, as it doesn't apply in this case, thank heaven. It's just a stipulation that you should not be in domestic service.
Oh.
Whatever's the matter, Miss Dunn?
I'm a cook, sir. Didn't I tell you at the house?
Done. I had no idea. This is very unfortunate.
There's a bit later on as well where basically David Suchet's like, you know, that wasn't really an Australian accent. That wasn't really Australian. And Hastings is just flabbergasted. Like, wait a second. It's like, obviously he wasn't there to hear how bad it was, but, you know.
There was no Australian, he says, wasn't he? And,
yes, there was.
So good.
It's so good.
There are some really good withering put downs in this episode as well. We've missed a couple already from the beginning.
Go on.
From Mrs. Todd.
Go on. Please do.
Mrs. Todd, when she first meets Poirot for the first time, and she starts off, Poirot loves flattery. That's a fact. So she starts off saying, like, oh, you're the famous detective. I read about you in the paper. And then she says, oh, did you pay for that bit in the paper saying how clever you are? Or did they put that in there themselves? And you can see his face drop, which is possibly why he's a bit rude to her to begin with, because he's like, hey, mean. Come on, Mrs. Todd.
Are you Mr. Poirot?
I am Hercule Poirot, yes, mother.
Oh, you're not a bit how I thought you'd be. Did you pay for that bit in the paper saying what a clever detective you were, or did they put it in themselves?
Madame.
Oh, I'm sorry, I'm sure. But you know what newspapers are like nowadays. Nothing but puff.
Le Sick Burn, I think that's got to be.
Oh, is that the Belgian French for it?
No, it's Flemish, don't check.
Le Sick Burn.
So, yeah, I think that's got to be the sickest burn. There's always a very good put down in all of these episodes. I especially like the porter at the end. It's just constant. It calls, calls Hastings. You know, I don't talk to the monkey, I talk to the organ grinder.
No, I've got it. I'm talking to the engineer, not the oil rack. Yeah. Something like that.
Le Sick Burn.
Savage.
Are you looking for this bloke or something?
Well, of course we're looking for him.
I'm talking to the engineer, not the oil rag.
Now, look here.
But like the standard, all the quality of the scripts all the way through, every episode is so strong. And they don't just, as I say, they're not just avatars who pop up and solve a crime and go home. They develop in all kinds of amazing ways throughout every episode. Poirot and Japp have their own relationship. Japp and Hastings have their own relationship. Hastings and Miss Lemon have their own relationship. Yes. Even Japp and Miss Lemon have their own relationship.
Yay!
Poirot and Miss Lemon, just, there's some such amazing writing in this, especially in, I know I keep harping on about this episode, but in the dream.
Yeah.
It's the one where Miss Lemon is inadvertently responsible for solving the crime, and you think she's going to get this incredible reward at the end. I won't spoil it, but it's so absolutely good. Brilliant.
Yeah. And it shows you that Poirot is not quite as clever as he thinks he is sometimes. It doesn't not quite as perceptive as he likes to believe at all times. But there is some great conversation between Hastings and Poirot in that one. There's that bit where Hastings is like, I was thinking of popping down to Sandown because he loves the races. And Poirot goes, no, you do not pop.
And you, Hastings, do not you run away with such celerity. I have work for you too.
Oh, matter of fact, I was thinking of popping down to Sandown this afternoon.
No. You do not pop.
Well, there's a horse running a pal of mine owns a leg of.
When he owns four legs, I pop with you. But now it's time for work, yes? As for me, I pop to the City of London.
Pop. It's so much better with a French accent, a Belgian accent. Jesus.
Thank you. It's very London. No. There's definitely a pound coin being held in place. And a certain scene on the bridge.
Yes, yeah, when they've left, I believe they've finished their interrogation at the household, at the Todd household, and they're walking back and discussing it. And a lot, straight away as well, that Hastings is like, oh, I think Mr. Todd did it. And he's like, not just because he didn't offer you a drink, Hastings. That doesn't necessarily mean that, yeah, he's a murderer. But yeah, you can really see the full glory of the mints. And you think, how far up is the coin at this stage? Is it secure?
I think he might have swallowed it, to be honest. I think
comes
that's
out
why
his mouth.
You never see David Suchet on a trampoline. I think that's because he would just, it'd be like shaking the piggy bank. quite a few times it's happened. What do you think?
Yes,
let's discuss that on a Poirot book. How respectful.
I'm so sorry if David Suchet ever listened to this, but it's out of respect for the craft that we mentioned. I mean,
we're just wowed by your method.
Oh my God, he must have buns of steel, truly. Like Claudia. He's been doing that workout, that Claudia Schiffer. Cindy Crawford one. Yeah. You know what he's doing.
What do you think of the fact that they chose this for the first episode? Do you think it's a strong enough one to kick things off?
I think it establishes the relationships really well within the four, like you say. Because as we say, they've added Jap in. He's not in the original book, but you get a really clear introduction of who everyone is, what their role is, kind of within the setup and the dynamic of their relationships. And you get a soft introduction to, I guess, the kinds of crime that you'll see in an Agatha Christie story, where it's, you know, there are some brutal murders, but you never see anything gory. And you never actually see, I mean, actually, there is quite a gruesome reveal at one point where they open and they find the body.
Yeah.
And it's a little bit like, oh, goodness, that's a little bit upsetting.
For a Sunday evening.
But nothing. Yes, my goodness. I think it's a good, we've discussed before when we talked about doing this and how it was an interesting choice to start with short stories for the first 10 episodes, because it's such a rich catalogue and there are such big name books, you know, like Murder on the Orient Express and Death on the Nile, like really big, well-known Agatha Christie. So they could have, you know, gone in with a big one right off the bat, but they chose to start with these short stories. Why do you think they did that?
I couldn't say, but it makes me inordinately glad that they did, because I think if they'd started with Mysterious Affair at Stiles, which, you know, chronologically would have been...
Yes. First book.
I think that would have been great, but I love the fact that they kept it for an anniversary episode, made it a full length thing, because it was almost like we know who they are already, and now let's show you how they met, kind of thing. I think it would have been a bit pat if they'd done it chronologically, but I love the fact that they do the short stories. I think it makes it really palatable, really easy to get into, and the mysteries. There's not an ounce of fat in any of these things. Every single scene's important, even at the beginning where they're talking about the grease spot on his jacket and you have noticed it better. I mean, just it tells you everything you need to know about their relationships. Like you say, it's a very... I wonder if they filmed all 10 and said which one would work best to air first. I mean, there must have been an element to that,
possibly.
I think. I think it's a good choice.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's potentially as well for... They spent a lot of money on them, clearly, but they thought maybe we'll just dip our toe in and see what the audience response is with these short ones. And then if people become hooked, which everybody did, then we'll go big and go with the big stories and give them that big production value that they deserve, really. Because the big ones don't come until way later on in the series. Like, they're kind of the latter end, and it is when they start getting a bit even bigger budget, bigger name stars, and all that kind of thing, that they go for the big ones. But thank God they started, thank God they did these ones, because it's, incredible.
As well, if they'd gone full length from the beginning, it would have been kind of, I don't know, it would have been really hard to do the smaller stories. Imagine doing Clapham or Murder in the Mews something when you've done Death on the Nile and Peril at End House and things like that. So,
I'm sorry to be crude, but you don't want to blow your load too early, right?
Well, that's the general rule,
with TV shows. So you don't want to, maybe that was the thinking, is if we start big, then no one's going to care about the smaller ones.
Exactly. Whereas
this built the love.
Yeah, it does. It's like you get to see them at home. I love it.
God, I just want to go watch more and more and more. That's it. It's the perfect show, isn't it? To just come home and just put on.
It really is, yeah. It works for anything. You can watch it in the evening, the afternoon, while you're making dinner, like I do.
Very good. It's the thing. It's funny. It's sweet, because their relationship is really loving and caring for each other. It can be quite scary at points. It can be quite thrilling and stressful. And it's just, it's everything. It's just perfect.
Yeah.
I hope people don't mind the fact that basically every episode is just going to be us gushing.
Oh, isn't it good? It's so good.
It's just, oh my God, it's amazing. There's not going to be any kind of harsh criticism, because it's impossible to criticise.
It's the best perfect TV show ever made.
Yeah.
Plus, at the backbone of every episode, you have the Fantastic Mysteries of Agatha Christie, brought to life by a once-in-a-lifetime cast. There's literally no other time in history that could have been made that would have worked as well. There's no one else who could have played these characters as well as these people play them.
Branner.
We had to mention it.
Sorry, and I swore as well. Perfection achieved.
Absolutely. So, we'll delve into people more next time. We'll delve into the next episode. But obviously, I think from both of us, it's a hard recommend. If you haven't watched Poirot before and you're new to it, and you're perhaps thinking, it's a series I've always spotted in the schedules, I never really dipped my toe. If you live in the UK, 100% you will have seen at least one episode in your life, because it's just on a loop all the time. And
it's an institution.
Yeah. Adventure of the Clapham Cook is the first episode, and I think it's a very good one to start with, because it nails, like I said, it nails all the intricacies of his character, I think.
Yeah.
The snobby part, you get the OCD part, you get Hastings at his I say best, and you get Jaff, and you get Miss Lemon, and it's a really good one.
That's another
plus
really good
one. It starts small and it ends really big.
Yeah. So, you're right. And there's a really iconic moment when, I'm not going to spoil it, but it's worth watching just for that. Look, there's one name that he shouts at the end.
Oh, it's brilliant.
Shivers down the spine. It's so good. But it's, I think if you do want to watch it, people listening, I think it's all on BritBox from what I hear, which I think is available in other countries as well, but it's well worth it. And if you think as well, I think Agatha Christie sometimes gets a reputation for being a bit soft and fluffy.
Yeah.
And there's a bit of soft fluff around the edges, but it's such a rich story. The genius of the writing, it makes it worth it. And just even just to look at the sets, the costume, the production of it, it's definitely worth a watch. You won't regret it, especially on a Sunday afternoon, like you say, if you're cooking or you just want to relax at the end of a long day. You can't go wrong. I think you'll love it.
It's very hard to watch one as well, especially of these shorter ones.
Oh yeah.
If you're watching series one, you're like, oh, let's watch another one, because they always end on these moments as well that make you go, God, I love this show so much. And if
That's
you're like
so
me
clever.
A nostalgia lover, it's just a visual feast. You'll watch it once for the mystery. You'll watch it the second time for Suchet and the moments you missed. You'll watch it for the third time for all the detail. And it just boggles the mind how they managed to fill an entire street full of 1920s automobiles, and how they had people walking in the distance in authentic period costume. It's, oh, God.
Incredible.
It's an incredible achievement, I have to say. It's one of the things I will always forgive ITV for anything, because they made the Poirot series, and the fact that they stuck it out and kept paying so they could put every single episode out there is what an achievement.
And it was a great investment for them, because from what I, from seeing David Suchet live in his house and also on stage, it's syndicated all over the world. I think it's translated into, hundreds of languages at this point, and it's got a huge international appeal. I think people in Japan know David Suchet's Poirot.
Yeah.
It's a huge thing. So it's, yeah, I mean, ITV, you would think, no, the ITV in the UK hasn't got the best reputation for making the hardest hitting, you know, big budget thrillers or anything, but they saw a genius kind of route to take that would last a lifetime, and it's still showing all the time because they know people will still watch it, and that's why it's genius. And Poirot more so than Marple, I would say, even, because Marple's been successful, but not in the same way as the Poirot series has for them.
No, it's slightly harder to connect with Miss Marple, though, I find. I mean, the TV...
Because you hate old ladies.
Yeah, famously. You know, don't mention old ladies, yeah, around me.
the rage.
Yeah, because also, as well, she tends to do things on her own in stories. And she's very quiet and very passive, and she doesn't tend to, like, interject until the
she's
end.
She's a listener.
Yeah, she's a listener. Mm. But with Poirot, he's a bit more dynamic. He's out there, he's solving it. He's got friends, and they're all brilliant as well. So.
Yeah. And he's qualified to solve crime, where she's literally just an old lady. Like, I love Marple, but she's like, she's just a nosy old woman.
Serious imposter syndrome.
Yeah, seriously. And they all just, like, by the end of it, the police are like, yeah, okay, let's let the old lady do it, because she's good. But she doesn't have any qualifications. She doesn't really have any... Yeah, reason to be there. David Suchet, well, Poirot, he's head of the Belgian police.
He gets a big Suchet.
There you go.
That's how we could rate the episodes. We could give them a Suchet or a Suchenet, although I don't think we'll ever use Suchenet.
They're going to get a Suchet every time. Yeah. I think so. It's going to be a Suchet. And that, when I emailed you about doing this podcast, my subject line, which I really debated doing or not, my husband was like, don't do it. I'm like, oh, I really want to, though. And I put David Suchet in the subject line.
I didn't even need to read the email. I was like, sold.
Thank God. Thank God you understand.
Yeah, Adventure of the Clapham Cook, then. It's a hard Suchet from both of us.
Case closed.
I do kind of want to gush about it a bit more, but I think, you know, we've been on
for quite a while.
For about an hour now, and it is an opener, and you can't really spoil the mystery. So.
But this is the thing. I think if we say any more, then we're just going to be reading out the entire episode. Just doing it. So maybe we save that, like you say.
Yeah, there's plenty more to talk about. I definitely want to dig more into the music maybe next time as well.
Oh, yeah, but let's do that in the next one, and the credits and everything.
Yeah. Well, then, for this inaugural episode, Investigation from the Labours of Hercule, it's been fabulous spending some time with you, Frankie.
Likewise. Thank you so much.
And we'll see you on the next episode for Murder in the Mews.
Oh, exciting. Very amusing.
Oh, just, I knew it. So, Suchet.
Yeah, fair.
If you'd like to keep up to date with what we're doing or get in touch with us, you can follow us on Twitter at Labours Hercule. We're also on Instagram if you like pictures at Labours of Hercule. And if you were born in the 1920s yourself, then you can be all old-fashioned and email us at bonjour@thelaboursofhercule.com. That's it from us. See you next time. Au revoir, mes amis.